You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly brought to you by Shox Bone Conduction Headphones. Right now, there's a £10 discount for Cycling Podcast listeners at uk.shox.com with the discount code CYCLING10. I recently took delivery of the flagship model, the Open Run Pro 2, and when they first arrived, I was a little sceptical because nothing goes into your ear, and it made me wonder what the sound quality would be like. Well, I needn't have had any concerns because Shox dual pitch technology means there's bone conduction for mids and highs with an air conduction speaker for deep bass. And that gives a great immersive 3D sound, whether you're listening to your favorite music or your favorite podcast. They're really comfortable too because there's ear hooks and a secure but lightweight frame to hold them in place, whether you're running or on the turbo or out on the trails. I think the fact that nothing goes in your ear, meaning that you retain full awareness of your surroundings without compromising that sound quality, is the real key factor when it comes to the Shox headphones and what makes them so comfortable. It's probably also why Shox has got so many elite level ambassadors, including Eliud Kipchoge, the fastest marathon runner of all time, and Eilish McColgan, as well as partnerships with Park Run and England Athletics. Since I got my pair, the Shox Open Run Pro 2, they've become my number one headphones no matter what I'm doing, simply because I really like that feeling of not having anything going in my ear. Over the years, there have been a few studies that have drawn a link between listening to music while training and improved athletic performance. And certainly I can identify with that feeling of getting into the zone, listening to music, and the sense that I can improve my focus and perhaps even delay the onset of fatigue if I get my playlist right. When I'm on the turbo, music is absolutely essential for me. But neither of my old choices were ideal. If I used a smart speaker, it meant that the rest of the house had to listen along to my dubious choice of motivational music. And if I used my conventional in-ear headphones, I found they could get sweaty and slip out or just become uncomfortable after a while. Neither of those are issues with the Shox headphones. If you're a swimmer or triathlete and you want to listen to music while you're training, you can do so with the Open Swim Pro model, which can be used underwater. Cycling Podcast listeners can get £10 off at uk.shox.com with the discount code CYCLING10. That's CYCLING10 at uk.shox.com. Now on with the show. It's over to Daniel.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on December the 17th, a birthday shared 35 years ago, so in 1989, by the first ever Eastern European McDonald's, which opened in Moscow, and the hit US teen comedy Saved by the Bell, whose male lead Mark Paul Gosselaar, aka Zach Morris, is a Cat 2 racer who once watched Paris-Roubaix from the Garmin team car. My name is Daniel Freeber, I'm the host of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, and if all of that sounded a little bit tenuous, then brace yourselves for the title of that episode. True Rolf, the Red Bull Rain idea. Yes, indulge me with your festive merriment and allow me to explain that Rolf is Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe head DS Rolf Aldag, and True will hopefully describe the long conversation I shared with him in Mallorca at the weekend. The matter at hand, not a sleigh ride together, but a journey back through the last few months, which represented a sort of year dot in the team's grand plan to join the cycling superpowers, precisely the Red Bull Rain idea. Rolf had granted us a similar audience in the same venue almost a year earlier to the day. Then, in December 2023, the team had just signed Primoz Roglic and controversially lost its Belgian prodigy, Kian Otterbroeks.
I mean, like, you know, from external, it looks a little bit like, hey, this is, you know, this is off-season entertainment. Like, let's buy some popcorn and, you know, like a big, big bottle.
As ever, that day, Aldag proved fascinating, candid company. So much so that for our penultimate review of 2024 episode, we thought we'd meet again, principally to discuss the season just passed, which saw the team collect 24 victories, including two very prestigious ones for Roglic, in the general classification at both the Dauphiné and the Vuelta a España in September. But of course, there were also disappointments, and none sharper than Rog's withdrawal from the Tour de France after a crash on stage 12. Just the last in a series of misfortunes that have struck the Slovenian in the Tour. On Saturday, we also heard Roglic announce that next year he will return to the Tour, but only after attempting to claim his second victory in the Giro d'Italia, his first main aim of 2025.
To choose the Giro, is, I mean, yeah, like Rolf said, together with the team, we decided like that.
He announced his schedule at a press conference in front of 30 or so international journalists before a more intimate gathering with me and a handful of other reporters a little later on. There, Roglic talked in greater detail about the teething problems of his first year with Red Bull, his hopes for the second, and broader themes like motivation. Maybe most striking was a meditation on what spurs him to keep striving at age 35, that I interpreted as a sort of paean to gratitude, the responsibility to honour our opportunities, our talents, our lives, by squeezing all that we can out of them.
Speaking to people who know you, well, if you ask people, why does someone want to win? They say that a guy might want to win because of fame, because of money, because of ego. They say with you, it's because you feel you sacrifice so much that you have to justify that sacrifice by getting the best possible result. What do you think? What would you say motivates you the most to be successful, to win?
Yeah, it's a hard question. Huh? You know what, the end is, I mean, yeah, hard question or not. I just want to be myself. Huh? I mean, I have a really incredible opportunity actually in my life on my time being here. I changed the sports from being a ski jumper to ride a bike. I could never imagine. Now, doing quite good on the bike, winning some bike races. Also, could never really imagine before. Is a pleasure. Huh? I mean, pleasure, and on the other hand, maybe responsibility to have that. So, just try to be me. Huh? Try to do the best. Yes, on the time that I have here. That's simple.
You'll hear Rolf Aldag's observations about what seems to make Red Bull's star rider tick and much besides in just a moment. But friends of the podcast can also hear the whole of the Roglic briefing in a Kilometre Zero episode that'll be uploaded to the Friends of the Podcast feed later today. Becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast gives you access to all of our Kilometre Zero episodes. There have been over 20 new ones this year, and there are over 300 in the back catalogue. It's an annual subscription, but there's a monthly option if you want to see what it's all about. We want to ensure that all of our regular coverage remains free for all, so supporting us as a friend of the podcast is a big help in enabling us to do that. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up. You'll receive an email with simple step-by-step instructions for how to add the feed to your favourite podcast player. It's very simple. On subscribing, you can be connected up and listening in a matter of minutes. And with that, and the advance notice that next week we'll have one last review of 2024 episode, a best of compilation of our 2024 Grand Tours. Now it's back in time to the weekend and over to Rolf Aldag and me on a swimming pool terrace in Palma, Mallorca. Rolf, wir sind wieder da. We're back, same time of the year at least, same place, more or less. Well, slightly different. Just describe where we are if you can.
Well, we are on the wonderful island of Mallorca, Hotel Royal Castina, the base of Bora Hansgrohe in the past, now Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. So another training camp, another big workload for everybody involved, and even more people than ever have been here in the past.
Yeah, even more people. I was going to get to this later in the interview, because just if you open up the team's page on, for example, Pro Cycling Stats, you see 14, I think it is, Directeurs Sportifs. And these organizations are becoming ever more bloated, I suppose. But Rolf, before we started recording, you're talking to me about wildlife. I was going to start by asking you about a different kind of wildlife. That's a rather rude way of putting it, but I was going to ask you about the concept of Ballermann and the Bierkönig, which one could say is a sort of wildlife. It's an unkind way of referring, well, wildlife would be an unkind way of referring to the kind of German tourist that this area is famous for. But tell the listeners, what is Ballermann?
To be really honest, I think you asked a little bit the wrong person.
I thought I did.
But I can tell you one of the experience we had here. So we've been here, you know, like it's quite downtown in the winter, but a few areas have been open, and I think it was the Oberbayern, and We went there on...
Which is a bar.
Yeah, wouldn't call it a restaurant, a bar. And so we went there with a group of people, including Jens Vogt. And so he was the very first time there. And
what year are we talking? Not mid-90s?
No, much, much later. It was after our career. So the whole point was, so we have been there. We had contact with, let's say, the wildlife, you call it, before. And for Jens, it was the first time because he used to train, with his teams, not in Mallorca and so on. And he was ready to throw away his passport.
Oh, God.
He said, he was shaking his head on the way home. He was kept on shaking his head. And he said, I really do not want to be associated with that style of wildlife, with that style of celebrating, partying. It was just a way too much for him. I do think it's, breaking out of the everyday, routines and for people who come here. And that's probably also why for us it's really not relevant. No, we're not seeking for that kind of stuff, changing our center of life over and over and over, living out of the suitcase, living in hotel rooms. There's really no big need for us to break out of our routines. And if we break out of our routines, it's probably more to go somewhere in the desert for hiking or, to a really quiet place. Mm. So there's a big difference. But yeah, the whole concept is get the beer as cheap as possible and get as much as you can cope with and, for a few days and then move on in your normal life.
Yeah, it's a kind of a German equivalent of another Mallorcan resort, Magaluf, for English people. Rolf, you talked there about drinking, post-career drinking, fortunately. I was talking to some riders at the Bahrain training camp a couple of days ago and they were talking about rider initiations. Now, I thought all of this kind of thing had disappeared from training camps. Back in the day, it used to be the case that particularly on the last night of the training camp, there would be some alcohol consumed. But they said that it's still something that happens. New rider initiations, in their particular case at Bahrain, I think they had to wear fancy dress. There was maybe a little bit of alcohol consumed. Does that happen at Red Bull, Bora, Hansgrohe?
We used to do it. It was a big part of the October event in the past. So what they call it, the beer mile. Yeah. So the beer mile was kind of like you need to drink one bottle of beer in one zip. Then you need to run a certain loop, which is about 200 meters. Then you come back, you drink another bottle, and you do that till you finished your four bottles. It's funny for the people around. It's not really too funny for the people doing it. But we skipped that. So we said, there is a time for everything. But we feel right now to say, we're not really standing for that kind of stuff. And if they want to go out and have a beer, if they on the team evening have some beer, that's totally fine. But like that organized, now we all must have fun at the same time on the cost of somebody else felt a little bit strange. So maybe it sounds strange, but we want to respect people and we put them in funny costumes. It's a little bit weird then to say from tomorrow on, you are the teammate I rely on. I want to win a grand tour with and so on.
This time last year, you and I talked a little bit about the difference, changing cultures in generations and how this generation is maybe different from your generation. But that is also something that seems to have changed over the years, young people's relationship with having fun, but particularly alcohol.
Yeah, you see a lot of trends, now we deal with vegetarians, with vegans, with...
All sorts of strange people.
No, I'm not saying strange, different people. Yeah. There's a lot more openness and flexibility. I do think if I would tell Walter Grotefoot in my days to not eat my steak in the evening before Tour Flanders, he would probably write me off, before we even pump the air into the tire. So, and I think it's also to say, people are standing up for their opinions in terms of no, I do not drink alcohol. Mm. And if you force me to drink alcohol, I'm leaving the team. I mean, you have that sort of people. And I do think we have to respect that. Mm. So as we cook vegetarian and vegan meals. Mm. So
your good friend and former colleague Brian Holm tells a lot of good stories about Walter go to foot, and how, if, for example, a rider said, oh, I'm sick, Walter would reply, oh, you have cancer then, because that's a real illness. And if it's not that, then I presume you'll be riding, you'll be racing tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, there was some funny stuff about his victory in Paris-Roubaix when he had 40 temperature fever in the morning, and he just rode it out by dressing up a little warmer, and then in the final he was there. Yeah, I mean, like, super nice stories. I would have difficulties to tell, to be in front of a rider now and tell him that kind of sort of stuff.
I should say that the whole wildlife theme, we started on that note, and that was because you were telling me about wildlife in, well, on a different continent. You live on the continent of Africa now. You live in South Africa. Just briefly tell me, well, tell the listeners what you were telling me about a little trip you took, I think, to Mozambique a few weeks ago.
Actually, to the border of Mozambique. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a resident of South Africa for quite a long time now, and but I never left the Western Cape. So that was the time now to say, well, switch off the phone, or actually go to a place with no phone reception. That makes it easy because, you know, you stop looking at your phone if you received emails or messages or somebody tries to call you. So we went to Tonga Beach, and which is in South Africa. But what's the special thing about it? There is like nothing 40 kilometers to the north and 60 kilometers to the south, other than huge turtles crawling out of the ocean up the beach, digging a hole, putting 60 to 80 eggs into it, and then back to the ocean. Now, what's so special about it? It's like, it's creatures there. It's like the leatherback turtle, which is in between 300 and 600, and the heaviest they measured like 900 kilos. Wow. Of an animal. Super calm, super quiet, and as close as you can think of to a dinosaur. And you know, if you're there in the night and you're close to that and you follow that whole thing, that's pretty impressive. That's probably, it's not life changing, but it's, you know, leaves an impression with you. And so yeah, I enjoyed that, and a few hippos out there, and you know, some stuff around. So it was a very nice thing, and puts you back to earth, down with both feet on the ground. You know, if you otherwise, you know, chatting from one plane to the other, and you know, being busy with trying to pass a white line that is written on the road, you know, make it really, really important, which is called, you know, winning bike races.
And that is your life, of course, for the other, well, 11 months of the year. And we are finally going to talk about cycling, Rolf. This time last year, when we did the equivalent interview in 2023, there was a lot going on. The whole Kian Uttabroek saga was sort of unfolding. You got a different saga involving a rider. Well, you're on the other side of that equation, a rider coming from another team. We'll talk about that later. But obviously, we were in review mode last year. We talked about the slightly disappointing season in 2023 that Bora Hansgrohe had and hopes for this year, 2024. Before I sort of put some of the, well, achievements of the team this year to you, just summarize for me how you feel 2024 went for the team.
Well, to summarize it, I think, you know, it has to be understood to say, like, well, there was like the delta was huge. So the delta from, you know, success to disappointment, you know, sometimes you have this season that's, it was a good season. And the peak was, you know, okay. And the lows were acceptable. Now, if you look to, back to our 2024 season, of course, you know, that gap was huge. So, you know, like, I mean, the pleasure, the joy of winning the Vuelta with Primož was huge. Because, you know, came out of a situation where like expectations were high. We come from a huge disappointment. We do not come super well prepared. The whole team comes with, you know, with emotions.
I was going to say expectations were high, but expectations were probably managed a little bit because we knew that he wasn't in ideal condition. It wasn't an ideal situation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, you know, he had massive trouble with his back. He dropped out of the tour, and also, one of the key guys with him, Alex Vlasov, had a broken foot, literally. And so, you know, like, so, you know, you have to come over the, you know, attributes like believing, and, you know, you have to believe, you have to be emotional about it, because logically, you would probably say, like, if we just purely look from the scientific standpoint, say this is going to be close to mission impossible. And then still, you know, turning that around. Also, you know, remember how hard Ben O'Connor was fighting at 7 minutes lead, and it was like, not ideal now. So what do we do? But never really giving up. And then as a team, pull that off. It was also having a little bit of a new shining star next to it with the performance of Lipovic. Of course, you know, those are the things that you always like to remember, you know, being working in a team. And then you also have to look into the 2024 Tour de France, which obviously was a massive, you know, like hit on our head, a big disappointment. You know, we have a new big partner on board with Red Bull, and we're like super thrilled and motivated and believing into our team. And then, you know, we go back home with zero outcome, with, you know, that, not that it's important, but it reflects a little bit with being the last in the money ranking. You know, that is... it's a big hit for sure. So the extremes defined the season 24.
And just looking at individuals as well, you know, you had some riders who, I suppose, if you were to be blunt about it, kind of saved you to a certain extent. You can look at Roglic, Dani Martinez, Lipovic as well. And then, again, to be blunt, there were some riders who underperformed, certainly in terms of tangible results.
Yeah, but you also, like, I mean, you know, like you try to get into the season, and I think, thinking back of where we are right now, Mallorca, we finished like with Alex Vlasov, podium, three times out of five races, podium. So you're kind of like, yeah, that's all right, we can build on that. And Jai Hindley actually did do really, really well in Tirreno Adriatico, for example. You know, like really taking on that battle there with Vingegaard and finishing podium. So actually that looked like, yeah, we're doing good, we're all right. Like Sanremo, Matteo Sobrero was in the front and being rolled over by, you know, Van der Poel chasing. You're kind of like, yeah, we're good. And then a really big hit of course was a loss of Lennart Kemna, you know, with this massive accident. And it's also when you've, at least for a moment, me, you lose a little bit the focus, or you shift the focus to what's relevant. You know, then it becomes like, yes, we want to win bike race, but now we're really, you know, suffering and struggling, and like our thoughts are with the guy who's now like literally fighting for his life in the hospital. So that puts it, you know, a little bit on hold. And then we knew at that stage, like, classics are difficult for us if we see the biggest of them. So, you know, kind of like going into a period that are super, super tough mentally for the riders, for the staff to sit up in Belgium for a long time, you know, coping with all the difficulties up on the cobbles there. I think we also, like, we finished two times podiums, but then in the main events, as planned, we were not really present, but you always hope for more. So it's just like coping with emotions and reality got us a little bit kind of like into this, yeah, it's okay. And then we ended up in these extremes from a really good, I mean, whatever was achievable in the Giro, we achieved. Stani Martinez, I mean, there's just, against Tadej, I mean, there's just no way anybody could have beaten him. So there was a maximum, and then that hit in the Tour, and then that comeback in the Vuelta. So that, like, really ended up in this massive amplitudes on highs and lows.
Again, going back to last December, Roglic had already joined the team, of course, and this was his first camp with the team. And I got the strong sense from you then, you knew he was going to be demanding, or you knew he was going to take the team to new places. I'm not sure you knew exactly how that was going to manifest itself. Talk to us a little bit about that. In which ways was he demanding, and did that start immediately? And because listening to him, particularly in the first months of the season, it was a bit of a running thing. With Primoz, you always have to try to decode, decipher what he's saying. But he did keep talking about the team needing to make more progress.
Yeah, and to get it out of him, welcome to our world, to understand exactly. Because, I mean, Primoz is a super polite person. So he will not be like straight in your face, like, you know, if things do not go wrong. I do think he gives people and the team and the structures more than a second chance. So if things go wrong, you know, he will not completely freak out and say it's now or never. So he has a high level of tolerance, being so, you know, so driven by the wish for success, still having that high level of tolerance with people around him. and we had to learn about that. So if he says something, he means it. It's not just a side note, it's something that we should really look into and, you know, get to someplace. Then I also think from the team that he came from, a lot of things were taken away from him in the sense of like they were organized. And he assumed they are the same way organized here. Which they weren't, you know, they were not.
Did you
not
know
organized.
That already? Did you know that you weren't at the same, or maybe not even, it's not a question of level, but you were very different from Visma? Or did it take him pointing out for you to realize how different things were at Visma?
Yeah, since we didn't have the, you know, complete insight into Visma, it's hard to know, like, what are they doing and what are we doing? And I do think then you need to bridge that, like, to listen to, like, you know, to him, to also Mark Lamberts, his coach, you know, on the sport management side, to try to understand what they really have done and why are the things running the way with Primož they're running. So it was a learning for both sides, and it keeps on being a learning for both sides, because it was not just, you know, 1 or 2 years for him to be there. It was literally his whole career in that environment. He did grow with that environment. The environment grew with him. So I think there is, like, you know, the big difference here. Just like if you have riders who change teams every 2 years, they have to be that flexible, and they will be that flexible. So, okay, so I look at the situation. I do understand what's going on. I don't have the expectation that it's going to be the same as it has been. And there is adaptation for both sides. And I do think, actually, you know, we upgraded our game. And I do think he also adapted in some areas. You know, when he needs something, he addresses it and not just assuming it will happen anyway.
Can you give any examples of things you remember that, just what we talked about, that things were done a certain way at Visma, done differently at Red Bull, and he pointed it out and now you've adapted?
You see now our off-bike hiring strategy. You know, what did we do here? Like, there is a massive focus on nutrition. Did we have a nutrition program? Absolutely. Was it, like, scientifically proved? Absolutely. Was it supported, you know, just by the resources, just by the quantity that we could deliver to the riders? Not at the level as at Visma.
So quantity of people.
People. Quantity of people. Really resources that you say, you know, they could dedicate their time to the individuals, to the riders, but then also to the chefs, you know, to get everything aligned. No, we didn't. So now, you know, like bringing Oskar Jørgentrop on board there, you know, obviously who was part of the Visma structure in the past as well, you know, you see that, like, I mean, he presented his department here to the team as well, and you see there's a lot of people and there's a lot of knowledge, you know, that came to the team, and there will be more time to educate riders, there will be more time to explain to riders. So so I think, you know, that's one chapter there. Then Dan Bickham, you know, to bring him on board to say, well, we have a super strong technical partner with Specialized that is literally doing everything, but now we also have, like, you know, an addition, because I wouldn't want to call it a counterpart, it's really like together in this, we have from team side resources that can much more, you know, report back to our technical partner, to talk to the engineers of Specialized, to, you know, like, to get where we want to be, and then to coordinate it with Johnny Whale to bring it onto the road. So, you know, there are certain areas where we think also in handling of people, we build it on the mental performance department via Red Bull. And so these are the three big ones, really, where we think of, like, yeah, you know, we were assuming, like, yeah, we give them training, we give them bikes, we give them everything, and now let's go. But there's more to do, and we take that on, and it will grow over time.
It sounds as though, beyond the results, beyond the fact he won the Dauphiné and the Vuelta, it sounds as though Primož has been a successful signing, purely from that point of view, in the way he has, well, brought new ideas and input, which has made the team go up a level. That's what I'm sort of hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was clear that we're not just with Primož. You do not aim for, like, you know, the upcoming next superstar. Mm-hmm. What do you get with Primož? You get expectations from the public, because if he doesn't win, you know, well, he always won in the past. So now suddenly he wins less. You know, where would that, like, fall back to the new team? So, you know, you take not risk, but you're aware of the situation, you will be measured against his past successes as a team. So it puts, in my opinion, positive pressure on it, because it's also somebody who proved he can win. So if he keeps on winning, great, you know, at least we continue. If he wins more, well, we prove ourselves we can do even better things. Mm. But if he wins nothing anymore, we should really question, like, why does that happen? Mm. So it comes with a little bit of pressure, but then it also, you know, he brings the confidence into the team. So we have a reason why we pin a number on and why we're at the start line if he's there. We don't have to freestyle to say, well, if we get lucky, we might do something with Primož. The good thing is, like, you can develop a plan how to win that race, which, you know, otherwise it's super difficult. It's always like, well, we might win if he's doing a mistake, if he's doing a mistake, if he's... And then we have to be there, but let's be flexible on the situation. So there's a little bit of shift on planning, that we can plan longer term, that we're not always reactive, but we can be active in, like, if we make it hard on that climb and Primož goes, there might be one or two, three people who can follow, but that's it. We can decide a race in a certain area. Mm. And I do think there's a big change to it. I mean, the team had it in the past with a Peter Sagan. That was also an outstanding one. But otherwise, it's just difficult, really, to plan that way. Might be exciting to go in without a plan, but, you know, and it also leaves opportunities. And once in a while, it's also a nice way of racing. But still, with Primož, you can literally prove a working system. Mm. Because the result, you know he has a talent, and the result is the outcome of the process. Mm. And that's different than, like, well, we don't know, actually, because we're just simply in that one-to-one situation. We're just not good enough at that stage. And with Primož, it's an upgrade.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here again to tell you that this episode is also supported by AG1. AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 high-quality ingredients to help you feel your best. Now, we're approaching the festive period, and that's a time of the year where, certainly from my point of view, the more considered approach to diet goes out of the window somewhat. I reach more readily for the chocolates and the mince pies and the savoury snacks. And some of those things are a little bit lacking in nutritional goodies, sad to say. Otherwise, we could live on them 365 days of the year, couldn't we? But this is a time of year, I think, that AG1 can come into its own. I've been drinking AG1 for a number of months now. I've been making it my morning routine. I get up, I mix my AG1 powder, just one scoop, into the bottle, mix it up with water, and it turns into a very pleasant drink. And it contains more than 70 vitamins, minerals, and other good ingredients that I know are going to help me to feel my best. I certainly feel like my energy levels are more even throughout the day, and I think that might be as a result of drinking AG1. Now, you can give it a try, because if you want to support your health now and in the long run, you can start with AG1 today. Subscribe and get a free bottle of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs, which will be ideal if you're going off on a training camp early in the new year. You'll get those with your first subscription. Go to drinkag1.com/cycling. Enjoy everything that you like to enjoy over the festive period, in moderation, of course, and drink AG1 every morning just to iron out some of those excesses that we all like to indulge in over the Christmas period. So drinkag1.com/cycling to check it out today.
I suppose one exception to that, people would say, was the Tour de France, in that you were relying on a Pogacar mistake, or maybe when you went into the Tour, even thinking about Vingegaard needing to make a mistake for Primož to win. How did you feel the first 10 days were going, generally?
Well, I think, you know, looking back now, of course, it's easy to say, but I felt like we spent a lot of energy before the Tour. So coming into the Tour, like me personally, and I think the riders would certainly agree, we felt mentally fatigued, rather than being like fully thrilled up for the Tour, you know, like at the situation. Anyway, you have so much adrenaline and you don't like see it that way. But afterwards, with how we went there, You know, it was like, okay, we did the altitude, that was right. Then we had really difficulties to get to Dauphiné. It was cancelled flights, was arriving at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Because just a series of nothing in particular. Yeah,
just like there was a flight cancelled from Alicante to whatever, Lyon, and then people were stucking there, and then some had to fly to Amsterdam, others had to do another, and finally...
Just the things that no one sees. One at home sees.
Finally, I think four of the seven riders arrived like 3:30 in the morning in the hotel. So, of course, you know, completely cooked. One day left to the race. But then we still took the race on, and we won Dauphiné, so kind of like you feel rewarded. So after that, we went, okay, we stay one night at sea level, and then we went up to Tigne to do an altitude top-up camp. And weather was absolutely, well, so to say, shit. You know, raining. And then, the mood slips away and you go down by car, you train in the valley, but it was still 11 degrees and raining. Mm-hmm. So it was just just not good. And then, traveling to the tour was super nice. Was like you have a little bit of a kick, with that plane with Red Bull, and you get the Red Bull experience. But then you're there.
Talking about the effect of the energy drink. Did it really give you wings?
Yeah. No, we flew
you
there.
You did a great job for your sponsor, Rolf.
It's talking about what they've done for us.
Of course, because the team, I should point out at this point, of course, the Red Bull involvement was unveiled just before the tour.
That was it. But then also the event. So we had our official team presentation at Red Bull, and then we jumped on this... DC-6 plane, so a plane from 1954.
Oh, wow.
And we flew then as a team, as a unit, to Florence. So, that was really outstanding to fly through the Alps. Literally, you're scratching with the wings left and right on the big mountains. It was pretty impressive. And so, you gave it another, adrenaline kick. But then you also realize tiredness comes in relatively fast, and mental stress, comes back. And I do think... And this one was it was a tough one. It was a long tour, and losing Primož made it 10 times longer, because then you're kind of without a goal. But we were juggling around with it. And if you look back to say, when Primož dropped out, he was on fourth, so not super far off. At that stage, we would not know that how strong really Pogačar was. Looking back to say, realistically, there was no way to beat him in that shape with his team. So, but when we lost Primož, there was already a very, very long journey, starting with the first altitude camp, never really relaxing, never really breathing in, always the tour. And I personally think we absolutely overdid it. We completely overdid it, put extra stress on us. Wow. And didn't have the experience or didn't have the courage to just say that's it. So in my opinion, retrospectively now, we should just have stopped the top-up camp to say, scientifically it's good to do altitude, it would be nice to spend some extra time above 2000 meter.
This is after the Dauphiné.
But in my opinion, retrospectively, we just should have called it off to say weather is not good enough, we can't do what we want to do, we kill ourselves mentally here, we lose what we're really here for, to also build the team. And but that needs is a big call. It's a change in direction. And when do you do those calls? Not necessarily when you have a superstar all coming onto your team, when you try to do everything in the books. And in the books, it was the right thing to stay there. With experience, with having the sense for it, I think it would have been better to go down.
And presumably some of the stress had come from all of these modifications that you guys wanted to make because of Primož's input over the previous 6 months. That there'd been a lot going on that front, I presume.
Yeah, there's a lot. And, it was a very positive. All the changes were not we're not good. It was we look for the details. We look for this. We looked for that. So, it was done in a very positive way. But sometimes we probably overloaded ourselves, our structures, and then you raise expectation that you just start to disappoint yourself. So not only, you know, Primož and the riders, but that we needed to be sure to say, well, you know, are we still on track here? Because that is a problem with the fast growing. You know, it's not just to say, now we have a new partner and we have more money. You need to have the people and everything to still make things happen. And this make things happen was probably the execution was a difficult part.
So we're talking there about sort of changes that the team was making because of Primož's input. Obviously, the way he left the Tour de France was because of a crash. And unfortunately, this has been a bit of a theme in Primož's career and in his Tour de France career. Well, let's talk about that day. Where were you that day? Were you in the team car?
Yeah.
Just tell us what happened from your point of view. How did you experience that day?
I mean, I think we have to remember the day before, because the day before Primož crashed already. He slipped. You know, he was there with Remco. I do think he did the really brave ride there, because if I remember it well, so Pogacar went, Primož went after him. He even dropped Vingegaard for a moment. Then, you know, Vingegaard came back, dropped him. So he was like, it was the order of Pogacar, Vingegaard, Primož, then Remco came back. Then they were like right kind of together. We say, yeah, you know, we knew we were like still on the way up. We knew like the last week's going to be difficult. So in that situation, we were like, it's a good day. And then, you know, his back wheel slips and he goes down. So, and I've never seen anybody doing better after a crash. You know, it's not really like a wake up call. There's always something, you know, like. So, you know, you go into the next stage, and it wasn't like a super, super tough stage in terms of, you know, climbing elevation or something. But, of course, every day is a stressy day. And we had specifically, like, an idea to say, well, what do we do here in terms of positioning? And we wanted to wanted to be on the safe side in terms of do not try to look for the shelter, because it's always busy. You know, we even take the wind side. We don't have to be the first team.
I was going to ask you, Rob, so because of Primož's history with crashes, had you gone into the Tour with and maybe the whole season, with a clear idea with how do we make sure Primož avoids crashes? Is it at the back of the peloton, the middle of the peloton? Is it the right or left of the road? Was that a big part of, or was there a sort of strategy to do with that?
Well, if we look into our team, it was even part of the selection process, because we opted for, like, you know, more bigger guys, more flat support to protect him from that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, once you're at the climbs, you have the legs, you don't have it. But if you don't get to the climbs, well, you know, that's always a problem. So even in the selection process, we really said, like, well, on purpose, say, well, if we crash out, then it's all a maybe. If we somehow get dropped, well, then, you know, we were not good enough. If we're good enough, we will win. But let's, you know, let's really focus on these difficult transition stages, on the tricky finals that you do have in the Tour de France. So from the beginning on, that was very clear. It's like we need to try to protect him, and also that keeps stress away from him. So be ready for the mountains when they come up. And even then, as I said, you know, like, if you think about, like, you know, let's assume flat road, wind comes from the right side. On the left side, you will have the shelter, but everybody wants to be there. So we, even specifically on that day, we said, we opted for, like, you know what, the wind comes from the right, but we stay on the right, second team on the right. That is ideal. So we're not completely killing ourselves, wasting our energy. But we don't want to get into that mix for the shelter, because we're willing to invest for Primož and still, you know, the crash actually happens on the left and just shoots across to the right and takes him off the bike, and that's what it is. And but yeah, for sure, when we got there and when we got out of the car and like see him and then, you know, gets on the bike, then we're all long enough in the business to understand like there goes our Tour de France dream.
And of course, as commentators, as armchair experts, we might be tempted to roll our eyes and say, well, of course, Roglic crashed again. You in your position, well, you know everything that has gone into that moment, so you can't really afford to think that, and you shouldn't think that. But is there a part of you that thinks this guy, unfortunately, has this weakness, and this is something that we're going to have to live with?
Well, I think this guy has, you know, a super high level of motivation. And maybe sometimes, you know, with his history that we're all aware of, like that he does not have, you know, under 17, under 19, under 23 racing in his legs, you know, like, yeah, it does go down. And if he goes down, he goes down quite hard usually. Mm. But why is that? That's like he puts everything into that. You know, it's not really that you can blame him for, like, yeah, he doesn't focus, he doesn't do that. He's like absolutely willing to go to the limit. And tries to get the best result out of it. So honestly, every time he crashes, I just feel really, really sorry for him, not for myself. Mm. I can ensure everybody to say, well, you know, I really feel sorry for myself, but there's zero blame. It's not really that you can say, like, yeah, but he should have, could have. Mm. I do not think he crashes a single time on purpose. So it's always like the consequence of something. And his history also proves that he comes back all the time. So, you know, it's a little bit of a... It's true. Mm. He has a history of crashing.
And you can't fundamentally change the way he sits on a bike. That might have something to do with it. The same things that make him very aerodynamic might also be the things that make him crash in a bunch. Who knows? Who knows? And you're not going to completely revolutionize the way he rides a bike, are you?
No, well, I mean, like, you know, I think he would be the first to say, if you can guarantee me not crashing anymore, yeah. I'm willing to put the handlebar behind my saddle, yeah. I'm pedaling backwards, frontwards, sidewards, because I don't think he really enjoys rehabilitation processes, no. Because he went through so many. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, like, he's not 21. Should we work on this? Absolutely. You know, should we try to dig into it to say, what else can we do? You know, like, how can we protect him? So, you know, on his side passively, so what can we do around him? And then actively on him, is there anything, you know, we can change on the position, on the vision, on reacting, on, like, is there any training we can do? And that's a good thing about Primož. If there's anything you can do, he would do it. Mm. I mean, he lives so much for the success. He's not interested right from A to B. He's interested in winning bike races, and he lives so much for the success. If there's something we figure out, like, this is will help him, I'm 100% sure he will do it.
Leaving Primož to one side for a moment, we're talking about a crash. Obviously, that was a big topic of conversation last year with the Vingegaard's crash in the Basque Country and other riders crashing in the Basque Country. I've heard people talk about next year's Tour de France and the first week of the Tour de France, and there are alarm bells already ringing about, well, the part of the world, the Northern France. I know you like Northern France, but you know, it's associated historically with crashes and so on and so forth. Just when all of these sort of debates were happening last year about making races slower, making races safer, what have been your reactions to that? What is your personal feeling about the direction the sport's moving in and how it can be made safer?
It's
a huge question, I know.
That's probably a one-hour podcast on itself.
Another 20 minutes, Rob.
Yeah, okay. What I clearly don't want to do is, like, you know, start the blame game here to say, yeah, it's all their fault, or this, or that. Mm. I think, you know, if we want to find solutions, we have to do it together. So in the interest of the rider, also in the interest of the teams, because, you know, ultimately, you know, we talk about, you know, payrolls of, what is it, 20 million plus that teams have. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is, like, have a big investment in the hospital or, you know, off the bike forever. And we also live from the reputation of the sport that we all know. It's a super hard sport. You know, it's a super, super difficult one. It's like it needs a lot of willpower, a lot of, you know, strengths, mental strengths and physical strengths. But we don't want to be seen as, like, kind of like, you know, like a showcase that is just known for spectacular crashes. Mm. You know, in the yearly, in December, every time, every TV channel comes up back with the sporting highlights. And actually, I don't want to see cycling only, like, you know, being present there by crashes. I would really like to see the man-to-man, the face-to-face, the Vingegaard against Pogacar, against Evenepoel, Roglic scenes, like these fights. Because I do think, you know, otherwise we don't want to be a World Series of Wrestling style, you know. So that's why I do think there is something to do. And then it's maybe taking things, you know, like to say, well, is it realistic to slow races down? it's in the nature, everything goes faster and stuff like that. But we have the advantage, we're not measured really against speed, no? If you see a 100-meter run on the athletics, if you would say, like, now we have to wear 2 kilo shoes,
and it's going to end up, we're stopping progress.
You know, feels like, yeah, this is not interesting anymore. Even if it's a photo finish, people always aim for, like, is he running under 10 seconds? So we have the luxury, we're not measured against it. Because if we go, you know, clockwise and we go northern France with full tailwind, it will be much faster than going anti-clockwise in the headwind. So that's an advantage. But how do we really slow it down? Can you slow down technology? Can you really say, like, well, we go back to 32 spokes and aluminium rim? It's a difficult one. So I'm not quite sure. I think the best way to do it would actually be, we talk about road conditions, road surface, course design, but then we also talk about the most expensive one. Because, you know, if you remove every roundabout that's in the way, if you remove, you know, like every narrowing in every city, that's difficult. Or if you're not coming to the people anymore, because that's a super nice thing about the sport, no? Like, they can literally pass in your front door if you live in the village center somewhere, you know, in the Pyrenees. If we say, like, we don't do that anymore, it takes a lot away from the sport. If we just take the, you know, the roads race around tracks, the village and, you know, like, and then we go on racetracks. And then you also remember when we finished on the racetrack, we might ask Fabio Jakobsen about finishing on a racetrack, how hard he went down. You know, remember, I think we had on 3 kilometer racetrack
in the Tour de France,
like 3 crashes. So, you know, also wasn't a solution. So it's just ticking boxes. I think road design, road furniture would be the logic one, because, you know, like, you can, on a Formula One track, literally, you can drive 300 kilometers an hour. Why is that? Because it's super nice surface, it's super wide, you know, it's super safe, because you have, I don't know, 50 meters to the fence with gravel, with tires, with, you know, whatever slows you down. So then we don't have to slow down the race if we go on that. Does that, you know, represent road cycling? Not really. So, you know, it's a tricky one. I also don't think it's a solution to say we take away race radios because everybody pushes, because then you have to take away all technology. Because right now, if you're a good sport director, you judge on the situation. You're not just reading down your notes to say, guys, go to the front, go to the front. Assuming that, it's like, for me, it's completely crazy that people in the car push bike riders over the edge for no reason. First of all, we don't want to have them crashing. Second of all, we know there's a certain level of stress you can cope with, but then they will put out the earpiece anyway. So, but what happened if you take out the radio? I can guarantee you everybody would program his bike computer, his head unit, with a red blinking alarm system if there comes a narrow turn. Now, if I do that by radio, I can decide, look, there's a breakaway, 4 men on 4 minutes, it's a steady pace, I will not push anybody to anything. That bike computer will not make that decision. That will blink and will give you a crazy alarm and start beeping and vibrating and, you know, changing colors from red to blue to green. So if you want to say, take that away, well, then take away all technology out of the sport, which I think does not happen either. Then we are like kind of like Eroica style. We all have a beer at the feed zone, and, you know, we put on the leather hat there with the cap, you know, to the front, and like no cleats and no fixed pedals, and we shift at the frame. I've not seen, like, you know, Eroica's covered 295 nations live for 5 hours a day, because people would not watch it. It's nice to do it, but it's not really what, you know, what attracts people. So it's a super difficult one. What I really warn about is, like, this kind of, like, you know, like, organizers blame teams blame organizers, UCI blames whoever, and, like, riders have their own opinion. That must be a let's do it together case rather than like I know it the best.
No, there's no silver bullet. It's going to be increments, slight improvements every year. Going back to Primoz, you talked a minute ago about him just wanting to win bike races. You've ridden with a lot of guys who won a lot of bike races, were very motivated by winning bike races. You've managed a lot of guys who also had the same imperative. What is it about winning bike races, do you think, that motivates Primoz? For some people it's fame, for some people it's money, for some people it's other things. In Primoz's particular case, what do you think it is?
I think it's, for him, it's a return of the input that he gave. So because he's really process orientated, so he wants to do things right. And then the logic is to win that bike race. So, you know, for him, he believes that he's not the most talented on the planet, but that he wants to show by hard work, by doing the right things, by being on the ball, by not compromising, that this pays off into results. So, you know, in many cases, not really that you say it's important for him. It's important for him, the victory itself. I think it's important for him, if I leave my family for 3 weeks at home and I go to altitude without seeing them, if I go straight from there to a bike race, then there should be a reward. And the reward is winning that bike race. So, you know, it's like, it's kind of like there's huge investments, and then there should be a reward. But that's only the consequence of the hard work that he is doing. So it's not just to say, well, you know, Primož would expect to win, or goes in say, yeah, I really want to win this, if he doesn't do the work. I think that would be a different Primož. You know, like that would be kind of like just to go there to go. I've never seen that. I think every time he puts a number on, he reflects like, what brought me here? And then you look back and say, well, you know, I went through rehabilitation, I went through a lot of broken bones, I went through, you know, a lot of times away from my family, you know, not seeing my kids. I went from a lot of investments, you know, financial and time investments to get to this point. And now I kind of like, I expect that return. And what is their return? Their return is winning that bike race. So I think that's a little bit, I'm not saying how he functioned, but how I see it works. If it would be on the start line with no training, with just say, well, yeah, you know what, put a number on and let's go. I think there would be different expectations, not necessarily you would say like, I do it for the sake of winning.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by a map.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Obviously, there was a lot invested in the Vuelta. Now, I remember at the Tour de France on the rest day, Primož gave a press conference. You were there with him. And I asked you actually privately, is he going to do the Vuelta? Or actually, I think it was in the press conference I asked you. And you weren't, I don't think you guys wanted to commit because you didn't want to give the impression that you're already thinking towards a plan B. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it was already on the agenda to do the Vuelta.
I was quite open. I mean, like, you know, there's a logic to it. It was not 50-50. It was towards the Vuelta, but it was not really not decided, because, you know, I do think like to think of like if there's a chance still to win the Tour de France and then you commit to the Vuelta, I don't think it's the right thing to do at that stage, because there would be so much stress coming in, and knowing, as I said, you know, how much we already invested into that tour, I think winning the tour, going to the Vuelta last year would have been the wrong thing to do. So we didn't know, but yeah, you know, at that time it was pointing towards the direction. But in many cases, also now, you know, talking about 25 on many race calendars, we say like, till then we plan everything, and after that we just have to see where we're at, because you don't want to screw people's heads in like, you know, losing the focus on one event to another event that is far out there.
And the decision itself to finally go, if I remember rightly, I can't remember who it was, someone talked to me about a day. He was staying on the Iseron, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Just above Tignes. And there was maybe a particular day when he decided, or you decided, Ralph decided, that, okay, we can give this a go, but with what sort of feeling, what expectation?
Yeah, that's it's also a lot of people are involved, of course. Yeah. You know, his coach, and he was also visiting him there. Ralph was there talking to Primož, so you know, also to show support, not to in any way put pressure on him, expectations, just to be there. Paci Vila went there, so you know, a lot of people went there. I think the first big step was actually to go there. Mm. Because, you know, he could have easily called it off to say, look, you know, like, I'm not ready yet. I preferred full recovery. I stayed down there. And then it would have been completely unrealistic to try to win the world with no proper preparation, with no altitude. So I think the biggest call was actually to go there, specifically there, even higher, even lonelier, you know. So yeah,
it's 2,700 meters. Yeah. Was he in the refuge at the top?
Yeah, somehow. Right. Yeah. So, you know, pretty lonely place. So that is a huge call to do. You know, to have that frustration from, you know, not achieving what you wanted to, and then say, yeah, but I do this. For me, that was actually the bigger step. Then finally, because we're back to like, okay, so I invest all of this, you know, went to the APC Athlete Performance Center of Red Bull to start the rehab. You know, of course, it's always feels like torture. All this rehab stuff always feels like somebody torturing you, but you need to get it, to do it, to get the movement back, to get, you know, like, to get to where you have been. So, but then it felt again like typical Primož and to say, yeah, you know what, we've done all of this, let's give it a try. Let's go for that. But at that stage, of course, it's super hard to go in there and say, yeah, of course we go here to win. Is it logic, you know, multiple Vuelta winner to go there to try to win? Yes, but we should always also respect others. You know, others are perfectly prepared. For others, it's their season highlight. They target nothing else than that. And then we should not go there limping. And going out there and say, yeah, of course we go to win here. Who else should win here? And I think that's a matter of respect to the race and also to the competitors.
Mm. We won't go through the whole Vuelta, Rolf, but the fact that he did manage to pull it off, obviously an amazing testament to this resilience that we've talked about. I mean, was there a moment for you where you did realise, or a sort of a light bulb moment? Because Ben O'Connor took a lot of time. The team seemed to panic a little bit the next day to Córdoba. There was a very aggressive tactic. It was the next day, wasn't it? And it didn't exactly produce the desired results, I don't think. But Primož looked solid. But was there a moment where you really started to feel confident?
Yeah, in Madrid. Yeah. Felt confident. No, we knew there is a way, but... since especially, you know, I have a little bit of a relationship with Ben O'Connor, of course, because I pushed really, really hard at Dimension Data to make him professional. And, you know, I really wanted to give him that chance and finally, you know, managed to get him that contract. So, of course, we always like a little bit in touch. And I do believe I know him at least, you know, like not in detail, not as a scientist, but how he clicks.
So you knew all his weaknesses.
No, but I knew his strengths. Yeah. And, you know, it's like I would not like plan on he's completely cracking.
Okay.
I would not plan on like, yeah, you know what, one day he's going to lose 30 minutes. Mm. It might happen if he's just, you know, in a miserable mood because he's ninth and, you know, ninth or tenth doesn't matter, you know, like, whew, then he would probably try some crazy attacks and then, you know, that's it. But if he's in the jersey, I hardly know riders who can go as deep as Ben O'Connor can go. And
he's a very emotional rider, isn't he? He draws a lot of fuel from emotion.
Exactly. So, you know, like, and that can play in his favor and that can play against him. But what was, for me, kind of like a little bit the scary part is, like, his team did do really good. So, you know, like, he could have been cracked if you would say like, yeah, you know what, after 80 kilometers he's alone, he looks around, he's alone, he sees this is completely mission impossible, and I do not own anything to anybody here because I get no support, you know, I won my stage, I had the jersey, screw this. But I think Ben O'Connor feels responsibility if the team is going to kill themselves for him, and that's how it looked like, you know, and they really took it on, and I think most of them performed above their normal average, And that puts extra positive pressure on a guy like Ben O'Connor. So for me, it was more like, people who said like he will crack. Mm. I was like, I would see it as like, you know, take second by second out of him. And rather than just thinking like we go all in, we attack him, he's going to stand still, and that's it then. So, and it turned out to be okay, but it also turned out that Primož had to go out of his comfort zone. Mm. So if he would be on 4 minutes, you know, he can do it in a different way. If you're on 4 minutes, you can say, you know what, we scrape off 10 seconds here and 5 seconds there with the speed that he has, with the explosivity that Primož has, and then with bonus seconds, we're getting there. But that was not an option. So if you remember how early Primož went on final climbs, that was pretty impressive and learning for all of us that he can do it. And that should actually make us pretty confident, you know, also for future races, because then we put ourselves into a situation where we didn't want to be. I mean, that's not secret. That it was not planned to get, you know, to start the Vuelta then with 7 minutes behind Ben O'Connor. That was not the plan. It was a consequence out of, well, a few situations. But then it would turn out to be very positive to say, well, look what Primož is able to do if he needs to do it. And that was, yeah, it was a good learning.
We'll talk a little bit about the future now. I feel like I've lingered on the disappointments more than on the success of the Vuelta, but that's what us journalists do. You know, we talk much more about the bad moments than the good moments. Rolf, maybe we'll learn in a couple of hours, because Primož is going to talk to us, and I think Ralph and you are going to talk to us about next year. Grand Tours next year. Has a decision been made about what Primož is going to do?
Yep.
Are you going to tell me? Am I going to find out later?
You will find out.
I don't believe anything you say anymore, because a year ago when I came to interview you, I said, Rolf, I've been hearing these rumours about Red Bull taking over the team. You said, oh, no, not, I don't know.
I didn't say no. No, I phrased it, I think, in a way.
You have a very clear memory of this.
I tried to make a joke out of it. To say, oh, really? Fucking, like, great news. And I like, played it completely down, made it sound completely stupid. But I never said no, because I really wouldn't want to do that. Not to you, not to anybody, to really lie into people's face if I know it's different. But I would, like, make it sound like, nah, that was a crazy question.
I'm very gullible. I take everything that you say at face value. So I thought Rolf would not, you know, he would not send me up the garden path, as we say. So we're going to find out maybe later.
We find out. Like, we have a very clear plan, and it's talked through with him. And, you know, there's like... So it was actually like a very nice process, if I'm okay to talk about it, to say, well, you know, like... It was an idea from us that we talked about it. We discussed then, you know, with Enrico Gasparotto as the head DS, with the performance team, with Primož's coach, and we had an idea. And then, you know...
Sounds like it's the Giro.
Gaspar said, like, you know what, let me go down and talk to him. And so, you know, like, spend 2 days with Primož, and, you know, he's our leader. So, you know, it's never a waste of time to speak to your leader. So do some activity together, go out for dinner. And then actually Primož came up with that idea that we wanted to present to him. So
okay.
Then it is actually the perfect fit. And yeah, it's going to be Giro and Tour.
Okay. With presumably, well, the goal to win the Giro.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That must be the goal. You know, as we said, like, he's driven by winning. He wants to prove... wants to prove himself. He won the Giro before, and that's an ideal scenario for us to say, okay, you know, we take that on. And it does not mean we don't take the Tour serious. We still take the Tour very, very serious. When we do believe, like, you know, with hopefully a victory in the Giro, it changed a little bit. It would change a little bit kind of like the approach to the Tour. Mm. Because, you know, if you win a Grand Tour, it's hard to make it a bad year anymore. Mm. You know, if you turn that around, if you think about it now, after the Vuelta, we were really on a high, you know, the team was kind of like felt more free to perform in the remaining races. So if we could achieve that, to say, well, we go to the Giro, we go out there with a really huge success, you know, the rest of the season cannot be a bad season, no matter what you do.
Mm. And I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying that you guys more or less know what the Giro route is. Did that play a big role or not huge?
It played a role. Okay. I mean, but then you also have to see, like, you know, we're not completely relying on time trials. So, you know, like, we're not in a Bradley Wiggins scenario to the Tour de France 2012 where it's all perfect, you know, few mountaintop finishes, perfect time trialing for me, that it's now or never. We was pretty much, we're in a situation like, can he win mountaintop finishes? Absolutely. Can he be really good in time trials? Can he win time trials? Well, he was Olympic champion. So I do think he's a rider that we believe still, you know, that on every kind of scenario we would have a chance with him. But we do know the course as much as we can know it. I think there was some irritation about like start and how and what and if. And there might be some minor changes because of whatever, you know, local situations and roadworks. But we're pretty confident that the Giro really suits him.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
And Rolf, I'm going to have to release you in a few minutes, but it would be remiss of us not to discuss some Germans. We started talking about Ballermann, and we're going to talk about some Germans. Florian Lipowitz was one of the revelations of 2024. We didn't know much about him. We still don't know that much about him. We know that he's got this, well, his family has this great history in biathlon, but he seemed to come out of nowhere in the spring at Romandy with a fantastic performance. And then, as I say, he turned into one of the revelations of 2024. Were you expecting the season that he produced?
Well, welcome to the club of not knowing too much about Florian, because
he's a quiet guy, isn't he?
He's a quiet guy, exactly. He will also not, you know, I just sit down and, like, you know, like, tell you everything that he has done in his life and what he plans to do in his life. I think he's a pretty close guy, not in a negative way, just in a shy way. We do this athlete development plans for every athlete. And there's also kind of like, you know, like, what we give them is a reason why we hired them. And it's also a team expectation. So I actively had to think about it. And, you know, like, I mean, he was seen as kind of like a project because he was very outstanding with his performance data, you know, coming from. But of course, he was messing the cycling history. And
because how long has he actually been cycling? Sort of 6 or 7 years, sort of mid-teens,
didn't he pick up?
It was a common story that he had a problem with his knees, I think.
Maybe luckily for us, maybe also good for him, who knows. But then, you know, he did do this impressive things that he did not do it to, like, point himself out to it. So he had a meeting with Ralf scheduled before he actually signed the contract. So a meeting to talk, to get to know each other. And he came by bike, 200 kilometers.
Oh, wow, nice.
So, you know, this is kind of like, okay. So he's a quiet guy. He's not promoting himself, like, as a superstar. But he's doing the right things. And so, you know, like, he went back by train. We just laughed about it the other day. So it wasn't 400 kilometers. Okay. But, you know, like, he just, okay, I have a meeting. I love to ride my bike. It's 200 kilometers. I go there. And afterwards go home. So I do think we were aware of his physical abilities. We were not sure about his tactical skills. We were not really sure about, like, you know, his technical abilities on the bike. You have a sense for it. But if you would have asked me to say, well, would you bet your money that he finished in a top 10 in a Grand Tour? No, and it would also be unfair to raise his expectations. Did we, in our talks before, we were very specific in our lead to the Vuelta to not waste him in a pure helper role. I think in that group was very clear. We pointed that out to say it's not the plan to focus him on specific stages because we believe in his GC, in his overall classification abilities.
And Primoz is okay with that?
Well, you know, of course we would make him ride if we have to make him ride, but not in the sense of like, you know what, you focus on stage 3, 5, 9, 14, and otherwise you're a gruppetto, because that's not how you develop Grand Tour riding. You know, Grand Tour riding is like going every day to a certain limit, but not far over the limit. But if you need to have that day of recovery, then you're not a Grand Tour rider. So you need to be able to keep on going. But it was also very clear if, and we have seen that also on the Granada stage, I think, if there was need for him, then he would do the job. And that's what he has done as well. So I do think, after Romandy, that was a surprise, I have to say. Romandy was for me a surprise. And I do think if he would have done it different, he could have won it. He would have won it, actually, because he had the legs to win it. But that was not really that, like, didn't shock me, but it surprised me. I was also in the car, and like, I think he was the best rider. If we leave him off the leash earlier, then he would have won Romandy.
Grand Tours for him in 2025, isn't it? Next year, yeah, 2025.
Yes.
Which you don't know, you can't tell me which ones.
No, it's a process with him. You know, we want to develop him also, like to give him leader roles. So he will go into the earlier races, you know, with leader, semi-leader roles. And then I think we're going to plan with him for Dauphiné as a leader.
Okay.
And then we will see where we're at. Yeah. We know the outcome of the Giro. We know where the team is. And from then on, we will see if it's going to be Tour de France.
Is he the Pogacar slayer, Rolf? We're all looking for a Pogacar slayer in world cycling. Who's it going to be? Is it going to be an 18-year-old that we haven't heard of, or a 16-year-old we haven't heard of yet, or could it be Lipovic?
It's a very difficult one right now. It seems that the gap from Pogacar to the second best is huge. Mm. So to improve, you know, from the existing, you know, top guys, to improve to the level of Pogacar, assuming he's as good as he was, that's a huge mission, that's for sure. So the likelihood that somebody comes from nowhere, well, maybe. Because when Pogacar won his first tour, we also thought he's going to win now for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
He didn't. He was beaten by Vingegaard. That at that stage, when we made that call, like he's going to win for 10 years, we were not really sure about Vingegaard either. So there's something out there. But if you see pure numbers and to say like we plan, oh, I have a plan how to beat Pogacar right now here, it's a difficult one.
Another three Germans I just wanted to ask you quickly about who are leaving the team. It feels like a bit of a changing of the guard. This is obviously a German team, and three riders kind of from not exactly the same generation, but Buchmann, Kemner and Schachmann, different stages in their career, leaving for different reasons, I suppose. But any sort of regrets about those three guys going away?
I mean, you know, like I think we have to make differences here to say, well, there's a personal aspect, you know, and I, you know, love to discuss with Max, because you can discuss days and nights with him, you know. I like this super, super dry humor of Emo, that, you know, he looks at you and he pulls something out that you're just, you know, you fall backwards. And I certainly like the smartness and cleverness from Lennart Kemner. I really enjoy, you know, like talking with him, and, you know, there's a lot of sarcasm in there. And like, so on that level, of course, it always feels like kind of like they have been a very essential part of this team. And you know, then it's always like, yeah, now they're gone. So, but I have to say from the team perspective on the sporting goals and from their perspective on their career, the point where they're at their career, it's probably the right thing to do then, you know, for Max to have a fresh start, to go back to where he had success also with Quickstep, and, you know, for Emo to really do something completely out of the box, maybe also get a little bit away from this German expectation to say, well, when is he taking over, you know, the Jan Ulrich role?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen
cycling
at this point. Yeah.
You know, you know, he suffered a long time from that expectations, and now he's in a French team. Where
he was upset with the team, wasn't he, at the Giro, before the Giro? I mean,
he was disappointed.
Yeah.
He was disappointed, but at least, you know, what I would say at least shows still ambitions.
Mm.
You know, if we were just like, you know, It is what it is. I prefer to have then riders who are really ambitious and then, being disappointed, than riders who absolutely do not care about, the races, their position in the team anymore. Now, should we discuss it publicly? That's another question, we talked about it, so it's all fine. But he was disappointed, that's very, very clear. And with Lennart Kemner, I just really hope he's on a good way back, that he's, finding, he has I think also a fresh start there. I talked to all three of them last week to thank them for their involvement into the team and to wish them all the best. And everybody picked up the phone or called back within 3 minutes.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, it is. And
no gray ticks on WhatsApp. Yeah.
Yeah, they are invited every time they cross the bus and they want to have a coffee, they're more than welcome, or have Red Bull. If they need wings, they're welcome.
Well, we've already heard what an incredible effect that had on you guys on the way to the Tour de France.
Yeah, so we're good with that, but I do think it just made sense.
Yeah,
it really made sense for them and it made sense for us.
Last couple of things. I suppose the Schachmann kind of replacement could be Van Hiels. Last year we said Kian Uytterbrooks was leaving the team, a big Belgian hope was leaving the team. Van Hiels is arriving. We know that now. We've only known for the last week. Why did the team want to sign him so much?
Well, it goes both ways, I guess, because it wasn't really we're not in the position just to call around and say, hey, come to our team. It's not that easy. I do think he is very ambitious and he sees the team growing and he's at an age where he thinks where do I get the best support and what is just happening in cycling? And I think, to be honest, we as a team were very attractive to him as a rider, which I also think it makes sense. We do have more focus on the one day races. If you see our signings, you wouldn't really necessarily think wow, there's a lot of guys, new guys coming as potential next Tour de France winners. But there's a lot of guys who have a kick, who can do something on the cobbles and can something in the dance and can do something in Lombardia, and
Piffy, for example, Fisher Black,
exactly, Lascano, how he came out of nowhere and really entertained us. And I think that's very attractive. And since I also believe it's really not easy to beat Mathieu van der Poel on the cobbles, man against man, well, what do you try to do? You try to go by quantities. You try to be proactive. You try to be anticipating the race. And for that, you need really big engines. And Maxime fits into the Ardennes really, really well with his way of riding, with his explosivity. And guys like Pithy and Lascano fit really, really well into the Van Dijk brothers. And we really upgraded, our one-day racing. And I'm super happy about it because I think it's a very nice part of cycling to watch, to be part of.
That's one Belgian. As a final question, Rolf, I wanted to ask you about another Belgian, Patrick Lefebvre, who was your boss and who is... I don't really think he's leaving. He's leaving his role CEO of Sudal Quickstep. He can be a controversial figure. He's obviously someone who's achieved an awful lot in professional cycling. What did he represent for you? You, of course, joined his team, and you were part of a bit of a revolution of that team in 2012, wasn't it? You sort of were part of a new intake of staff who really dragged that team, I suppose, into a new era. Yeah, what would you say about Patrick Lefebvre and his career?
First of all, when you say I can't believe he's leaving, is that a wish from you, or is that kind of
I mean, I'll miss his quotes, but I do believe that he is going to still appear, and he probably still will be feeding his sound bites outside of team buses.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm also thinking. It's kind of I miss his quotes. He's controversial, there's no doubt about it. But he's also, because you mentioned 2012, you said we and coming in and part of being, of the revolution there. But the point is, he allowed us to do that. A long-term manager was very successful in the past with Mapai, opens the doors to a new group of people, allow them, to change things within his team. that's also credit to him to say, you know, it's not really that he's just like completely a concrete head and it's like, it's my way, it's this way. He has very strong principles. He doesn't always like has the right tone in his quotes and stuff like that. But I do think, you know, like he has a place in cycling. He had a place in cycling and he has a place in cycling. For some, it's a wake-up call. For some, it's like, you know, rethinking. For some, it might just be, you know, like putting up their blood pressure. But, you know, I do think that he achieved a lot. And I have to say, you know, I'm like looking back to say, I'm very thankful also because remember when I came to that team, basically he offered me a position. And for 1 year, more or less, turned it down. I said, look, you know, I want to try something else. I went to Ironman there. I have been managing director of Ironman for 1 year. Mm. And then realizing, like, you know, cycling is really my passion. And he kept the door open. There was no need for him to do it. He could have said, you know, I integrated what I needed. I have Tony Martin. I have Brian Holm. I have, you know, the guys that I wanted to have. You had your chance. Ciao. But he didn't. So so also like I'm pretty thankful for that period.
You must be very good at your job. That must be why.
I don't know, but he, you know, like I mean, it's just not like that. He was, yeah, you disappointed me. You turned down my offer, so we don't talk anymore. So I had a very good time. I do think like the backbone of that team is the staff, is you know, the structure, is the people that are relevant to him, for him. And therefore, yeah, I repeat myself, like he had a position in cycling and he definitely was a big part of a very long area, you know, like guiding that also. I mean, he even had these positions, IIGC, AIGC president and so on. And all the controversies with Hein Verbruggen, if you look back, like, you know, like, and he's not the guy of like that you said, like, you know, like, and also not disrespectful, but if you look at Jean-René Bernardot, he's also a team manager. But then you think of like what Patrick Lefebvre done also in moving cycling forward. And, you know, Jean-René did. You know, he's a very traditional team manager. He's very traditional. You know, he has his fundamentals. He has his bases. And that's what he's about. But Patrick is this kind of like, if there's something that makes them better, he will consider it. So, you know, a 70-year-old guy who's still open-minded is also not, like, you know, the standard. So,
Well, Patrick is, I'm not sure exactly what his age is. He's around 70. You're only 56, I believe, Rob. You're going to be around for a long, long time yet. And, well, as ever, it's been fascinating listening to you over the last hour plus. Let's do it again next year, but let's do it in Bierkönig next year.
I promise we won't.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.